Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Droer, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We're here today to discuss Samia v. United States, which was argued before the court on March 29th. It's my honor to introduce our guest today, Robert McBride. Mr. McBride is the partner in charge of the Northern Kentucky office of Taft, Stettinius, and Hollister. He previously served for over 15 years as an assistant United States attorney in the Eastern District of Kentucky, and for 10 years in the United States Navy Judge Advocate General's Corps. And with that introduction, I'll hand things over to Mr. McBride.
Here the issue is, in what context should a non-testifying co-conspirator statement be brutalized? Should the test be within the context of the evidence of the trial and other obvious factors like the number of the defendants, or should we use the four corners test that is currently in use in many districts, which essentially means you look at the document for its in and of itself, much like you might an affidavit and a search warrant, and determine whether or not the document immediately implicates the co-conspirator, the co-conspirator whose statement is not being admitted into the trial. So this case is kind of interesting on a factual basis. Samia worked for a man named Paul LaRue. LaRue was the head of a transnational criminal organization. They conducted drug trafficking and violent acts, money laundering. And in order to support this organization, Mr. LaRue had what he called teams of mercenaries. Samia got involved in this organization in 2008 as a mercenary, and at one point expressed an interest in acting as an assassin. LaRue directed a man named Joseph Hunter to assemble a kill team to assassinate a woman named Lee. Lee was a real estate broker in the Philippines, and LaRue felt she had cheated him out of quite a bit of money. So Samia and others assassinated Lee with a man named Hunter. Hunter later told other members of the organization about the murder and ended up doing so in a secret meeting in Thailand where he was being recorded by American law enforcement. He was then arrested in 2021 and became a confidential witness for the DEA and was then arrested in 2013. Petitioner Stilwell were arrested in 2015. Stilwell waived his rights and made a confessional statement. In 2017, the indictment was handed down and the petitioner Stilwell were charged with murder for hire under 1589, conspiracy to commit murder for hire, conspiracy to commit murder and kidnap in another country, carrying, using firearm in relationship to a murder, conspiracy to launder money, although Stilwell wasn't charged with this last count. LaRue pleaded guilty, and petitioners Stilwell and Hunter all went to trial. So the issue was whether the brutalized statement was sufficient. As a basic kind of pretext of the law here, Burton says that a confessional statement of one co-defendant that implicates a non-testifying co-defendant violates the Confrontation Clause, even with the jury instruction. There have been cases since then that essentially say a properly redacted confessional statement that does not on itself or immediately identify the co-defendant is not a violation of the Confrontation Clause and may be admitted. So when we get to the Supreme Court arguments, the petitioner is arguing, in essence, that the Bruttonized statement must be evaluated by the court within the context of the evidence available to the government and other circumstances. In particular, what was important to the court was the example where there were simply two defendants on the case. And they went through a number of iterations of a hypothetical where a statement was made and entered by the government in a non-testifying co-defendant, where it was quite obvious, despite the fact that the redacted statement did not directly identify the co-defendant, where you've only got one other defendant, it seems pretty obvious on its face from the hypotheticals that the co-defendant was being implicated. Well, let me talk a little bit about some of the questions from the court. So what I thought was quite interesting was the proposed rule that seemed to be coming out, that courts seemed to be refining, and that Justice Comey Barrett essentially asked that, isn't the proposed rule to apply only where there are two defendants with non-testifying co-defendants? In other words, are they asking for an absolute ban on that? Because that does seem to be the most relevant circumstance in which the implication that the statement incriminates the other co-defendant would take place. You know, whether it was I committed the crime with her, or I committed a crime with one other person, or I committed the crime with even by myself, may implicate the other singular co-defendant that is sitting there. So the line of questioning essentially started to get down to is, well, is it ever possible to have a Bruttonized statement appropriately? The petitioner's position was that yes, interestingly, yes, they're not asking for Bruton to be overturned, but rather that this means of doing it within the context of the evidence and the circumstances surrounding the indictment, that kind of Bruttonized statement is more is much less likely to implicate the Confrontation Clause than simply looking at the four corners of the document. And of course, there are other remedies the government could use, which is not use the statement at all, further delineation of the Bruttonized statement, sanitize it even more, sever the trial so you have two defendants, and even sometimes you have two simultaneous juries that hear the different evidence, which actually I've seen used in these kinds of circumstances occasionally. The government's position was, well, I think somewhat weaker. So the government essentially said, you know, we look at the four corners, Judge. It's, you know, if it's properly done, it isn't going to implicate the Confrontation Clause. It isn't going to, on its face, be immediately incriminating to the defendant. But I think here the government got more pushback because even during the argument, the government lawyer had to concede, yes, you know, you while we look at the document, the four corners of the statement itself, there are going to be other circumstances that the government may emphasize the judge should take into consideration when brutalizing the statement. So if I had to make a call on this, I think that the petitioner may prevail here. In my own experience, you know, working with judges, they will sort of think about the case in general. In fact, they almost have to when they're brutalizing a statement or accepting a brutalized statement by the government. And I think that's particularly true when you only have two co-defendants sitting at the table. The jury's naturally going to think, well, this person has to be here for something. And where you have such an immediate impression of guilt of the other co-defendant, the court generally feels that a jury instruction isn't going to cure that issue. I'd be surprised if there's a special rule for two defendant jurors, but I think there may be a little more carving out of a little expansion of what's required when properly brutalizing a co-defendant statement.
All right. Thank you for that. So how does the fact that this is a joint trial impact the legal issues at play?
The statements of the co-conspirator would not be coming in. Also, they could actually put the co-conspirator on the stand, and then we wouldn't be having this issue. This case could be tried in front of the bench, and then they wouldn't have this issue at all either. One of the concerns with the confrontation clause is that when you have this statement by a non-testifying defendant, there's some concern in Burton about whether or not a jury instruction, well, the concern is a jury instruction is not enough to protect the confrontation clause rights of the other defendant. Even though the jury instruction says, look, you only consider this statement for defendant B, not defendant A.
So what questions were you interested to see come before the court during oral argument? And also the counter to that, what questions were you interested to see not appear before the court?
Well, I think in Sania, what I thought was most interesting is the government, while they did a great job at their arguments, I think they had to give some ground under the practical role. What the approach the court sort of boiled down to was, okay, this is sort of a functional problem. How do we make a Burtonized statement appropriate where there are co-defendants and one statement is coming in? And so the jury understands that one statement is only to be considered against the defendant that gave it. So I think that because it's a functional line of questioning, it's really going to become, I think, there'll be some expansion of what a court has to consider when it's evaluating a Burtonized statement. I also think that it will make it a little harder for the government to Burtonize certain types of statements, particularly where you have a sprawl, a conspiracy that is not sprawling, where it's really just two people involved in the conspiracy. What I thought the court, they did focus on it somewhat. I thought they may focus on a little bit more is jury instructions. You know, it's a very basic part of trying cases in criminal court where jury instructions, both during evidence, admissions during admonitions during evidence and jury instructions and admonitions in jury instructions are deemed as the proper remedy for any of these kinds of constitutional violations. So there was less discussion of the jury instructions than I expected as a prophylactic for this problem. I think the test would be, so if you look at this series of cases, it goes from a co-conspirator statement is that identifies the other defendant is too much. It violates the confrontation clause. To a redacted statement is appropriate. To a redacted statement can't obviously be redacted. To a statement can be modified so that it is basically true, but doesn't implicate the co-defendant. And so if you say, I and the defendant and a couple of other guys, as the Burtonized statement, it could be I and a couple of other guys committed the crime, or a couple of other people, so that while it's factually accurate, it isn't directly implicating the defendant. So I think it may be one more step. Now you have to look at the context in which the evidence will be presented before a judge will approve a Burtonized statement. And I think that it will be most germane where there are only two defendants at the table. Let me put it this way, where there are only two defendants involved in the conspiracy. You got, you know, five defendants and two of them have already pled guilty or what have you. It may not be as big a problem. So I think it'll be another edging out of what's appropriate brutalizing of a co-defendant statement. I don't know that any other out-of-court statements would be impacted. Most of them are going to be hearsay. I don't know what the full record was. There are exceptions and exemptions to the hearsay rule. I don't know that this will have any impact. This is a pretty discreet issue, these brutalized statements in co-defendants. It may lead to more separate trials, but not many of the judges I've practiced in front of really want to waste the time, if it will, the judicial time, the witness's time, the defendant's time, and all that goes into a trial to have a lot of separate trials.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUS Cast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.